From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up on the eve of Election Day, we're going to take a look at all the important races across New England. That includes the Massachusetts gubernatorial race. Democrat Jay Gonzalez says Republican incumbent Charlie Baker is putting party loyalty above all.
The governor is saying his loyalty's to the Republican Party, regardless of the consequences.
Baker says it's just a deflection.
This isn't a race for attorney general. It's not a race for the U.S. Senate. It's a race for governor.
We'll check in with political experts across New England. Also today,
young people haven't voted at more than 21% for a couple generations, since 1986.
Will this year's midterm break that trend? A new poll says it could. And a leading Catholic voice says she's lost her patience with the church. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is the eve of the 2018 midterm elections, and we are going to start today with all things politics. Joining us here in the studio is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Good to be here.
Hey there. And also here with us is Boston Globe political reporter and a WBUR political analyst, James Pindle. He joins us on the line from the offices over at the Globe. James, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be back on.
Thanks for joining us. Anthony, let's start with you. You spent the weekend covering the Massachusetts Senate race, which is between incumbent Democrat Elizabeth Warren and Republican challenger Jeff Deal. A poll last week done by WBUR showed that she was ahead of Deal by more than 20 points, but we know that polls are no guarantee, especially
That's right.
anymore. So what's been the closing strategy for the two campaigns?
All right. Well, this race, I think more than any other race in the state, reflects these stark divisions that we see across the country around President Trump. It's a clash between Jeff Deal's support for the president and Warren's interest in replacing the president. And Deal is trying to capitalize or weaponize Warren's interest in running for president. She says she's going to give it a hard look after the election, and she's been laying the groundwork for a possible run for months now. So here's Deal talking about this this past weekend in Fitchburg.
Senator Warren, just the last 2 days, was in Ohio and, you know, Wisconsin. Instead of focused on Massachusetts, just shows her lack of commitment. I think the voters out there realize that. So we're getting a lot of support.
Now, Warren responds to this by saying, hey, I'm committed to Massachusetts. I've held something like 40 town hall meetings in recent months. I'm running against a guy who wants to go to Washington and says he wants to have President Trump's back. So here's how she put it yesterday at a Democratic rally in Worcester.
My opponent wants to go to Washington to be the one vote that is needed to take away health care from tens of millions of people across this country.
So, Tiziana, Deal is trying to make the case that sending a Republican like him to Washington would give Massachusetts a seat at the table. Warren is arguing that a Senator Deal would work against the interests of most Massachusetts residents.
Yeah, and Anthony, Jeff Deal has been very clear about his very strong pro-Trump position and support for the president. Does he turn this race into a referendum on Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. And to the extent that it is, I think it helps Elizabeth Warren because this is a state, after all, that voted 2-1 against President Trump. On the other hand, Deal isn't running away from Trump in any way. He co-chaired the Trump campaign in Massachusetts. He certainly avoids Trump's divisive rhetoric. He's kind of a nice guy, but he nevertheless embraces Trump's policies, including his tough line on immigration. He's a big supporter of the Republican tax cut. So, yeah, I think this is a race more than any other in the state that is a referendum on President Trump.
So, James, let's pick up on that, because Elizabeth Warren has held a strong lead in the polls throughout this whole thing. But we do know that President Trump received more than 1 million votes in Massachusetts in 2016. Does he have a shot to win running as this very pro-Trump, all Trump all the time kind of candidate? I think we may have lost James. So, Anthony, let me turn that question over to you. Oh, are you there?
I am here.
There we go.
Great. We can quote the election returns from 2 years ago, or we can reference a poll from 2 months ago that showed that Massachusetts was more down on Trump than any other state in the entire country. We were arguing that we are more of a resistance state than California. So this go all in strategy on Trump, I understand it. It is very much in line with what other Republicans are doing around the country. Look, midterm elections tend to be about, can you get out your base voter? More than it is, can I appeal to independent voters? So I understand why Deal is going all in that way, but this may be a particularly bad state overall to be doing it in.
Now, James, there's also an independent candidate in this race, Shiva Ayyadurai. Do you think his presence in the race will affect the final results?
Well, he's been getting a lot of support in terms of a person without any party backing at all, having to do it all on his own. But the margins that Elizabeth Warren has been ahead in this race, 20 points or so, means that he's really not going to make the difference. And if he does anything, he may be taking away from the anti-Warren vote that would be helping Jeff Deal.
So, Anthony, so Ayyadurai might be taking away from the anti-Warren vote. Elizabeth Warren seems to be kind of reflecting the national picture in this race. She's been one of the more vocal critics of the president. How much does Massachusetts or can Massachusetts reflect the national picture tomorrow in the Senate race?
Well, I mean, I think it reflects the national picture in a big way. I mean, you've got Trump sort of looming over this race in a big way. You've got Elizabeth Warren running against Trump in a big way. And you've got her opponent, Jeff Deal, the former co-chair of the Trump campaign, who pretty much represents, as James said, who's sort of going all in for his support of President Trump. So I think this really is the race that does reflect that sort of national division that we're, you know, this is a real referendum on the president tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, James.
One side note on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
One side note on this, which is, you know, it's fascinating. He's going, Jeff Deal's going all in on Trump, but Trump has yet to actually officially endorse Deal, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting.
What do you think that means?
I think he's got bigger fish to fry. I mean, he's much more focused, the president, on those states out west, those so-called red states where he thinks he can pick off a blue Senate candidate in states like Montana, for example. I don't think anyone in the White House would think it would be worth coming up to Massachusetts and doing a rally to try to get Jeff Deal elected. It's just the odds are too long.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that, James?
That's fair, but my only point would be that Trump had took the time to tweet his support for the Republican candidate for governor in Connecticut, but he's not doing who's not a big Trump person, but he's just completely staying away from Deal, even though that's been Deal's whole campaign strategy.
Interesting.
So, James, let's stay on this Trump dimension for a second and talk about Trump and Warren, because Elizabeth Warren's been very clear that once this election is over, she's going to take a hard look about running for the president in 2020. What's your take on how well she's balanced running for re-election as a senator here in the Commonwealth versus establishing groundwork for a potential 2020 presidential run?
You know, there are a number of folks trying to do the same exact thing. Bernie Sanders, for example, who's also trying to travel the country, trying to figure out his path in 2020 while also seeking re-election in Vermont. I think one of the surprising things when you look back on the course of this U.S. Senate race is that it has not been more competitive. I think if you were to ask Jeff Deal or his two other Republican people who ran in the primary, if they thought that there would be some more support from, say, a super PAC that would at least try to tear down Elizabeth Warren ahead of a presidential run, they probably put that in their calculus. The mere fact that this race has not been competitive, when Elizabeth Warren, you know, won only one election, it's her last election, and 6 years ago she only got 54% of the vote. This is not exactly like some incumbent grabbing 60-70% of the vote. I guess you would think on paper 2 years ago this would be more competitive, and the fact that it's not has allowed Elizabeth Warren to have more freedom to travel around the country and not really be hurt by it.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think that she's seriously considering running for president has made her, in a way, more present and visible, and visible in Massachusetts, ironically, because it probably has to do with the fact that if she's going to run for president, she needs to engage with voters, she needs to debate her opponents, she needs to be seen and to be present. And so even though she's been running around the country, as James says, campaigning in the Midwest, and other battleground states, she's been really visible and accessible here in Massachusetts in a way that she wasn't before. So in a funny way, I don't think it's hurt her at all, even though Jeff Deal has tried to make an issue of it.
So the Senate race has been...
And Anthony's right. And one last point, sorry to interrupt there,
That's okay.
That Anthony made a very smart point there. What's really happening in the last, say, 3 or 4 months with Elizabeth Warren is this Senate campaign has been spring training for her running for the presidential race.
Yeah,
she's
right.
Trying to, as you mentioned, she's been doing all the town halls around the country, trying to get ready for those audiences in Iowa and New Hampshire. She's been doing the debates, trying to do prep work, trying to take it seriously. One thing she interestingly has not been doing is running a lot of television ads. So she's been sort of banking a lot of that money that obviously going to help her when she runs for president.
Thanks for that. I do want to make sure we cover a couple of the other races. Let's turn to the one that's happening at the state level here that seems to be intensely more local, and that's Democrat Jay Gonzalez challenging a very popular GOP incumbent governor in Charlie Baker. A poll from last week that WBUR did had Baker leading by more than 40 points in that race. Anthony, how has he been able to stay so popular with Democrats who might also be voting for Elizabeth Warren in the Senate?
Well, I mean, Charlie Baker, is one of those old-style New England Republicans. He's somewhat conservative on fiscal issues. He doesn't like to raise taxes, but he's a liberal and he'd be a Democrat in just about any other state. So I think that appeals to a lot of Democrats in Massachusetts. He's pro-choice. He's pro-gun control. He's pro-LGBTQ rights. He's pro all of those sort of liberal cultural issues. And so he's able to straddle that line. And he's also got a pretty good economic record to run on as well. So while Jay Gonzalez would like to nationalize this and like to pin Donald Trump on him, Charlie Baker, in a way, can rise above it and sort of say, hey, I'm not running for the Senate. I'm not running for attorney general. You know, I'm running for governor and folks know my record.
James, Gonzalez has been trying to do just that, which is pin a lot of the Republican candidates on Charlie Baker. Doesn't seem to be working. Does he have a shot? This is the flip side of the Warren and Deal question. Does Gonzalez have a shot to beat Charlie Baker in this race? And if so, how?
Well, boy, the odds look harder for Gonzalez to defeat Baker than it is for Deal to beat Warren, if you just follow what people are saying. You know, on Friday, for a story I was working on at the Globe, I was trying to search for the actual Jay Gonzalez voter with the arguments in the end were working out. And I went to all of these liberal enclaves here in Massachusetts. And it was really hard, number one, to find a Gonzalez voter, even in these liberal enclaves. But what was fascinating to me is, you know, in the past, those voters who split their ticket, right, they generally will vote Democrat, but then they'll pick a Republican or vice versa. There's a point of pride for these folks that, you know, I'm an independent voter. I'm reasonable. I can vote for people on both sides. But that's not actually what happened when I was talking to liberal after liberal on why they were voting for Charlie Baker. They were almost apologetic about it. They're like, look, don't judge me as a progressive. You have to understand why I'm voting for Baker. They go through down the line of things that Anthony just mentioned. But there's one other thing that was hugely significant, and it goes to the premise of your question, which is that from the outset, Charlie Baker did not get branded as a Trump Republican. And if you look at some of these polls, particularly from Mass Inc. and Suffolk University, that really drill down on this question, do you think Baker is anti-Trump or pro-Trump? You know, 2 out of 3 people would say he's anti-Trump. And the argument then from Gonzalez is that Baker is not anti-Trump enough, which is already more of a subtle argument. But I think that was probably the most significant thing, even with the economy being strong, even with his positions, one of the most significant things that he gave no breathing room to any Democratic challenger.
So before we turn our attention to one other race, I want to take us out of the Republican-Democrat-Independent tension and look at one other historical thing that's set to happen tomorrow, which is that Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley stands ready to become the first African-American elected as a U.S. representative in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. What does that mean for the Commonwealth, and why will that be an important moment? James, go ahead.
Well, it is an important moment. And look, this is a district that was created for this reason. This is a majority-minority district just in terms of constituents. And Ayanna Pressley is obviously a rising national star, and she's someone we'll be looking to a lot.
Anthony, what else?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I guess I would just say it's taken a long time and it's about time. I mean, she's the first African-American woman who's going to be going to Congress representing the Massachusetts. This is a majority-minority district. It's about time, I would say, and good for her.
So it's really an interesting and complicated set of factors. You've got tension between Republicans and Democrats on one side. You've got a Republican who seems like they're going to take it away pretty quickly, pretty well. On the other, you've got a Democrat doing the same thing. Let's turn our attention to Maine. We're going to do one more race here. I'd like to look at the race in Maine because there are two pretty close races going on there right now. And one is the race for governor, and the other is a second congressional district race where Republican Bruce Poliquin is running for re-election against Democrat Jerry Golden. Is there anything specific that either of you is watching from Maine that people should pay attention to?
I love that congressional race in Maine. I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, among other things, I mean, this is one of the races that is sort of, you know, the bellwether for how the whole country may go. I mean, this is one of the key races for control of Congress. It's also interesting that this is the only Republican, Poliquin, who comes from New England in Congress, and he could be voted out. Maybe he stays. We'll see. The polls have been really close. But this is a race that I'm really interested to watch tomorrow.
I do think it's going to be quite interesting. All right. Now, James, last question. I'm going to turn to you, and we're going to turn to New Hampshire, where incumbent Governor Chris Sununu, who held a really big early lead, suddenly finds himself appeared to be tied with his Democratic challenger, Molly Kelly, in a new University of New Hampshire poll. It says 49-49. Are those numbers real? Is she really closing the gap?
Well, it's very possible. She's definitely closing the gap. But the most interesting thing there is Democratic turnout. That's what's so hard to gauge here. And the UNH pollster suggested that Democratic turnout will be at least 13 points higher for Democrats than it is Republicans. And if it's exactly that high, then it's going to be exactly tied. If it's not, then the Republican will be fine. It's going to be so hard and so unpredictable, these elections. You know, most people didn't even think she was going to be the Democratic nominee. But then there was such record turnout and people wanting to vote for a female candidate. And the Democrat is Molly Kelly versus Chris Sununu, the Republican, that, you know, I think a lot of people are going to be watching this race, but they're skeptical as to whether or not it's really tied.
Great. Thanks, James. That's James Pindle. He's a political reporter for the Boston Globe and for WBUR as a political analyst. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, can you hang tight for a few minutes? We'd like to check back in with you in just a bit.
Happy to do it.
Thanks. We're going to now zoom out and take a look at some of the big races in other parts of New England, building off those couple comments. Let's go back to New Hampshire. And there is a tight governor's race and a historic contest for the second congressional district, as we just discussed. Joining us now to talk about all of that on the phone from Manchester is Professor Dante Scala. He teaches political science at the University of New Hampshire. Hello, Professor. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. I'm well. Thank you. We're going to focus on two big races here. First, the Republican governor, Chris Sununu, and his reelection bid against Democratic challenger Molly Kelly. Incumbent governors in New Hampshire, they've typically been able to secure their second terms pretty well. And Sununu has earned pretty high approval ratings, being one of the most popular governors in the country. This year, though, seems to be a little different. This latest poll, as we discussed, shows that Kelly is tightening the lead. One poll has them at 49% each. What is changing and making this race so close?
Well, you look at the fundamentals of the race, right? You look at the state of New Hampshire's economy, which is strong. You look at how do New Hampshire residents feel about their state and its direction. The answer is pretty good. You know, all of those things, plus the fact, as you mentioned, that first-term governors tend to be a lock for a second term, and it does make all of the recent polling, you know, a bit hard to explain. I will refer back to James's comment earlier. A lot depends, I think, on whether Governor Sununu is going to suffer the effects of an anti-Trump turnout, and whether there will be a lot of voters who show up whose primary concern is not really the governor, but is to send a message to Donald Trump. And along the way, will they decide to basically vote Chris Sununu out of office because these voters are voting straight Democratic. So a key question for me is, at the top of the ticket, before they get down to the congressional races, will they, these voters, make a decision, well, you know, I'm going to separate out Governor Sununu from my feelings toward perhaps, you know, Donald Trump, perhaps the rest of the Republican Party. Governors tend to have a separate identity from their political parties because they're so well known. And that's what might well save Governor Sununu tomorrow.
Let's go ahead and talk down about that down ticket race where I erroneously referred to it as the second congressional district. It's actually the first congressional district. New Hampshire is a purple state, and we've had a lot of conversation about a blue wave. But with incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter retiring from her seat, they have an opportunity to make history with whoever gets elected as her successor. We've got Republican Eddie Edwards. He would be the state's first African-American congressman. And we've got Democrat Chris Pappas, who would be its first openly gay congressman. Now, this seat has switched back and forth between Democrat and Republican control for the past few cycles. Do you think either party has an advantage here?
Yeah, I believe Chris Pappas and it will stand to be the beneficiary of Democratic enthusiasm. We saw that 2 months ago in the September primary when Democratic turnout far exceeded Republican turnout in the first congressional district. And both of them represent, you know, they're candidates without the ideological edge that characterizes our national politics today. Eddie Edwards, for example, defeated sitting New Hampshire State Senator who was regarded as ideologically very conservative. Chris Pappas certainly identifies as a progressive, like a lot of Democrats do, but he's never going to be mistaken for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren type of progressive Democrat. So we've had in this race, it's been kind of noted for its, you know, quote-unquote civility, and it's been a very quiet campaign. You haven't seen the national parties playing in this district race to the extent that we have in previous cycles. So it's been, for New Hampshire overall, and in the first district, a quiet race compared to some of the House races that we're seeing around the country.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch tomorrow the ways New Hampshire does and doesn't mirror the national wave. Professor Dante Scala, who teaches political science at the University of New Hampshire, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You too. Now let's check in on our neighbors to the south in Rhode Island. Joining us from Providence to talk about the races in Rhode Island is Scott McKay. He's a political analyst for the Publix Radio in Rhode Island. Scott, hello.
Great to be here with you folks.
Thanks for joining us. Scott, there are six candidates in the governor's race in Rhode Island, but the main contenders are Governor Gina Raimondo and her Republican challenger, Alan Fung. Alan Fung, if elected, would be the state's first Asian-American governor. Does it look like Raimondo will be able to hold on to the head office?
It does. A bunch of things are working in her direction, first of all, as is the case in Massachusetts. It's a good time to be an incumbent. Given the improving economy, one thing that Rhode Island has benefited from has been the spillover of the blossom in the Massachusetts economy. You see more people every day if you go to the train station in Providence, commuting to Boston. We have a lot of people who live in Rhode Island but work in Massachusetts, and that's really helped things here.
Okay, so that's helped. However, we know that Governor Raimondo's approval ratings have been among the worst in the nation. Why do you think that is?
You know, it's difficult to really divine. Part of it, I think, is the path-breaking figure that she is. She's the first woman governor. She likes to break things, and she's disrupted things. And she says being a change agent has hurt. Some of this goes back to when she was general treasurer, and she took on a huge project, basically, that ended up with a legislative approval of her initiative, cutting benefits in pension benefits to unionized state workers and school teachers. And that upset a big piece of the Democratic base. And some of those folks are still upset with her. Other people think she spent too much money in taxpayer subsidies trying to attract new business here. They stay here for a few years and then they move to Boston. There's also the loss of the minor league baseball team, the beloved Pawtucket Red Sox, the Boston Red Sox top minor league team. that has been in Rhode Island since the early 1970s.
Has that been a big topic in the race? Has that been an issue?
It hasn't been a huge issue because the governor has been lucky enough to deflect a lot of the blame to the House Speaker, a fellow named Nick Mattiello in Cranston. He's from the second largest city in the state. But basically what happened was that Rhode Island couldn't match the taxpayer subsidy that Governor Baker up in Massachusetts and the Worcester City Council put together to lure this team to a new ballpark in the Canal District in Worcester.
All right. So just before you go, Professor McKay or Scott, Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse is in a Senate race with Republican challenger Robert Flanders. This is an interesting race, given that we're coming off the heels of a tense Senate confirmation. And Senator Whitehouse, a tense Senate confirmation around the Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Whitehouse is on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which presided over those hearings. Has that impacted that race?
Yes, that's one of the major issues that his Republican opponent, Bob Flanders, who's a well-regarded former state Supreme Court judge and a former Brown football star, Harvard Law School, very bright fellow, had a great career here. He came out of the box saying, you know, after this Kavanaugh hearing, that White House sharp questioning of Brett Kavanaugh embarrassed the state. And, of course, the flip side for White House was no. It empowered women. One thing about this race is there's a huge gender gap. Both of the major polls that were done here, one by the University of New Hampshire for our radio station, the other for a local CBS affiliate television station, showed wide, wide chasm between men and women. In this race, and I think around New England, you're seeing this, a lot of women are tilting Democratic this time. It's not a good year in a state as blue as Rhode Island, which is, we kind of laugh, it's like the color of Narragansett Bay on a sunny July afternoon when it comes to politics this year. Being a Republican in Trump world, given the president's big disapproval ratings here, has really hurt Flanders.
So, you know, you mentioned the women's vote, and I think it's going to be interesting to see which way women break in a lot of races tomorrow. Meanwhile, Scott McKay, who's a political analyst for the Publix Radio in Rhode Island, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
All right, Anthony, we've covered a lot of ground. I just want to come back to you one more time for your final thought leading into Election Day.
Well,
tomorrow.
Just listening to Scott, listening to Dante Scala talking about all these races, I mean, the big question tomorrow is to what extent the anti-Trump backlash is going to motivate Democratic voters. You know, to come back to the New Hampshire governor's race between incumbent Republican Chris Sununu and Democratic candidate Molly Kelly. New Hampshire governors face re-election every 2 years. As Dante Scala says, they usually win re-election. So if Sununu goes down, it'll be really extraordinary. And I think it would be a reflection of that Democratic energy. And I was talking to a Democratic insider up in New Hampshire just an hour or so ago, and he predicted that tomorrow's election is going to be 2006 all over again. So that was halfway through George W. Bush's term. A lot of concern about the Gulf War. It was a Democratic wave, but in New Hampshire, it was a Democratic tidal wave. And he thinks that's going to happen tomorrow. We will see.
Well, 2006 to 2018, what waves happen? That's Anthony Brooks. He's the WBUR senior political reporter. Anthony, we're going to check in with you again on Wednesday once the votes have been counted.
Indeed. Thanks. There might be one or two things to talk about on that day.
That's right. Say, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. As we head into this election day, and every election day, we hear it over and over again, young people vote at lower levels than other age groups. That's despite the fact that those under 30 now actually are the largest potential voting bloc in the country. And it's also despite repeated pushes to turn out this historically low youth vote, like this online ad.
Dear young people,
don't vote.
Don't vote.
Everything's fine the way it is.
Trump. That was us.
He's our guy.
Climate change? That's a you problem.
So, you'll like some meme on Instagram.
If the weather is nice, maybe you could go to one of those little marches.
You might even share this video on Facebook.
But you won't vote.
You young people never do.
Well, if the numbers from a new Tufts University poll are right, young people will vote, and at historic numbers in tomorrow's midterm. That poll found that youth aged 18 to 24, some 30 4% of them say that they are extremely likely to vote. That's a level that rivals their participation in the 2016 presidential election. So joining me now in the studio for more on youth voting and tomorrow's potential turnout is Kay Kawashima Ginsburg. She's the director of Tufts University's Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, or CIRCLE. Kay, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into the specific results of your poll, why haven't younger voters turned out in the past?
You know, this trend is really specific to midterm and actually goes decades. Young people always voted at a lower rate in midterms, usually around 20%. There are many, many reasons for that, one of which is that the groups that usually reach out to voters don't reach young people in midterms because there are less resources, so they always reach out to people that are voting very frequently. Young people usually don't fall into that category either because they're young or because they're inconsistent voters. The media also covers the local elections less well or less frequently. So young people often feel like they don't really have a candidate they can vouch for. Unlike in presidential years, they really feel like they can like or dislike the presidential candidates and are out to vote for that.
So I am excited to get into the poll results, but we have seen some concern over polls getting elections wrong. So we also hear about how young voters are hard to reach for pollsters. They're less likely to answer or even have a landline, et cetera. How did you conduct this poll, and how confident are you with the results?
We're fairly confident because we went to one of the best polling companies that keep an online panel of really nationally representative household that get computer and internet access if they don't have it. So they're consistently answering questions for a certain period of time, and they're really nationally representative. We've had good experience in the past polling being pretty accurate. So it's not like we're cold calling young voters and see if we answer. So we're not like a pollsters. We're sort of a research institution, so we did it that way. So we're pretty confident. And, you know, if they really do come out in numbers anywhere close to 34%, that would be record-breaking in so many ways. The highest we've ever seen the 18 to 24-year-old bloc come out to vote was in 1982, when about 27% of young people came out to vote. It's been a while.
Okay, so let's talk about what the poll found, because this 34% number of extremely likely to vote is interesting. What's going on there?
So, you know, this would represent about 10-point increase from the last polling we have like this of midterm. And there seems to be many things that are driving youth vote when we look at our survey data really closely. The people who say that they have been reached out, of course, are far more likely to say that. They also say that if their friends are talking to them about politics or reaching out to them about becoming engaged, they're also more likely to vote. Interestingly, this year, the people that are saying they feel more cynical about politics than 2 years ago say they're actually more likely to vote. Usually for young people who are being cynical, they're less likely to vote. So that's somewhat surprising. And, you know, of course, there are so many things that happened since the Parkland shooting. That tragedy triggered so many activism by young people themselves, but also the groups that came out to help the young people who are feeling engaged and motivated to go ahead and become registered to vote. And being registered to vote early in spring and summer really helped young people get on the voter roll, which then helps young people get reached out by, you know, campaign groups and issue groups, then we're also seeing that in the data. The number of young people who are reached out is higher than expected this year.
So I'm really interested in this tie to activism. Your poll really focuses on 18 to 24-year-olds, which is a younger subgroup of what we usually call millennials and who are sort of often stereotyped to be quite disconnected. So what role is this kind of activism in Parkland or the hashtag MeToo or Black Lives Matters? What role is it playing in really engaging this younger subset of the young people?
So this generation that we surveyed this year sort of goes into the so-called Gen Z generation. And so that's 18 to 22 or 23-year-old now. And that generation has sort of came of age in the middle of surge of activism, starting with Black Lives Matter or student immigrant movement, and now Parkland shooting. So they have kind of grown up with a different culture around being right into politics instead of avoiding politics when it's not working out for them, like it may have been for millennials who started a lot of nonprofits and did a lot of volunteering. Those were great, but they tended to say, well, I'm not going to vote because it's not going to change anything. The Gen Z is saying, I'm going to vote, and I'm also going to protest. So they're quite different in the way they engage with politics, it seems.
And tell us a little more about these issues that are driving young people. So they're engaged, they're being active. What's causing that? What are the issues they care most about?
So there is no one issue that young people seem to be uniting around. When we did survey the young people on these issues, the number one issue they were able to name was actually affordable health care, believe it or not. Unlike maybe some people may expect, it's not that different from older people. Jobs were next, college affordability, immigration were next. But those things really varied by the subgroups of young people, both in terms of ideology and sort of subgroups. Women and men differed quite a bit, and people of color differed quite a bit from white people too. But when we asked about the movement, they also had a lot to say about that. Mm-hmm. So things like Me Too movement and gun safety and violence movement and reproductive rights kind of issues were all attracting a lot of support, as well as activists. Climate change would be another.
And is there a Trump effect? So those are, you know, serious policy issues, but we know the president looms large in these midterm elections. Is there a Trump effect?
You know, I think when young people said they're feeling really cynical about politics, and saying they're also going to engage, that may be tapping into that. We did ask about favorability of President Trump and saw, like any other polls have shown, very, very widespread disapproval of his performance so far. But we didn't actually hear specifically young people, from young people, that they're casting their ballots in opposition for President Trump. There seems to be just many other issues that they can engage with.
All right, so that leads us to prediction time. Given your answers to those questions just then, do you think this is the start of a new trend where we're going to see more younger voters turn out, or is this potentially a one-off kind of uptick?
You know, I may dare say that this may be a start of a trend. I think we're seeing enough signals and signs that point to just different attitude around political engagement generally, and the sense of identity that has to do with being voter so much earlier than we might usually expect. We, of course, expect that voter to be part of people's identity by the time they're in their 30s, but we usually don't hear that as early as 18 and 19-year-old. But we're seeing that now. You know, 18, 19-year-old are just as likely to say they're going to vote. So that's exciting.
It is exciting, and we are certainly in interesting times. Kay Kawashima Ginsburg is director of Tufts University's Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, or CIRCLE. You can find a link to their youth polling data, which she discussed with us here at our website, radioboston.org. Kay, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. With the Time's Up and hashtag MeToo movements, sexual harassment is being seen for the treachery it is, and those who perpetrate or enable it are being called to account in life-changing ways, but not in the Catholic Church. That conclusion comes from an op-ed in the Boston Globe, which was written by Helen Drinan, who once ran human resources for Caritas Christi, the Catholic hospital system under the Boston Archdiocese's leadership. Currently, President Drinan is the president of Simmons University. She joins me now. President Helen Drinan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Now, before we begin, I want to note that President Drinan and I have worked together in some similar professional circles for a long time, that I've held a senior role in the Archdiocese previous in my career, and I am a faculty member of a Catholic university now. So, President Drinan, you wrote your op-ed. You said that it was motivated in part by your 2006 experience as head of human resources for the Caritas Christi hospital system. Just to give some context to our listeners, Dr. Robert M. Haddad, then the CEO, was accused of sexually harassing women at work. As head of human resources, you got involved in the investigation and found those claims to be credible. Then what happened?
After the claims were found to be credible, we had investigations that were done by the Human Resources Department and investigations that were done by an outside lawyer that really were the same investigations, just making sure we covered all the territory. And we reported our findings to the lawyer for the Archdiocese of Boston, who then reported them to Cardinal O'Malley.
And what happened after the report to Cardinal O'Malley?
Well, we had a meeting with Cardinal O'Malley, and I was asked for my opinion about what should be done. And I said that I felt very clearly that we should terminate Dr. Haddad's CEO status at Caritas Christi. And we should do so because we were very, very, very sure of the facts. We had investigated very carefully, and because every previous employee at Caritas Christi who had had comparable violations of our sexual harassment policy were, in fact, terminated.
And ultimately, was the doctor terminated?
Ultimately, he was. It took a little bit more process in between the first meeting and the ultimate termination, but he was indeed terminated.
So now it's more than a
actually, he resigned.
Okay.
But the termination ultimately was the outcome.
Ultimately, yeah. The doctor left the hospital.
Right, so exactly.
Thanks. And I appreciate that clarification.
Yes, it is a clarification because you can be terminated or you can choose to resign.
Yeah. So it's more than a decade later now.
Yep.
And one of the things that was really striking in your op-ed is you said, I feel called by the Holy Spirit to discuss your experiences in that instance and with Cardinal O'Malley and with the Archdiocese. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you a little bit more about your motivation. Mm-hmm. Why write this piece now?
So why now? I think I do indeed believe that we have guidance available to us at all times from the Holy Spirit. And I have prayed over this constantly. We're reminded at church every week to listen to the influence of the Holy Spirit in our lives. And for many Catholics, that is an integral part of how they think about their faith lives. I was particularly impressed by the results of the Pennsylvania grand jury report regarding the systematic abuse of children, thousands of children in throughout all of Pennsylvania, practically.
This grand jury report came out in August.
Yes, it did. And by the active and collaborative efforts to keep that secret within the Catholic Church, it was only through the effort of the legal system, the Attorney General in Pennsylvania, that this all came forward. And it just seems like, especially that afternoon at church when the priest came forward and said, this has happened and Cardinal O'Malley wants to convey that he's very sorry. He knows that Catholics are getting impatient, that the secular world is not holds no confidence in the church. I just thought, here we go again. And how many more times can we do this without really losing complete attachment to the church?
So I hear in that answer really the answer of a Catholic. I also wondered as I was reading your piece, how much of your piece came from you as a leader and how much of it came from you as a woman? And I wonder if you'd discuss that.
Those are great questions, Tiziana. I am the leader of a 6,000 student university in Boston. We employ thousands of people in the educational endeavors. And I know that the buck stops with me. No matter what goes on in the university and no matter what mistake someone has made, at the end of the day, I'm responsible for that. And I believe that is the only way that an organization can really stay true to itself and true to its values. When the leader knows everything that goes right or wrong, it's my responsibility. So as a leader, I believe strongly in accountability at the top. As a woman, I feel very responsible for speaking up for the unempowered. So many times we as women feel voiceless and unempowered. And over the course of my life experiences have helped me to have a voice that I use as frequently as I can on behalf of others and sometimes on behalf of myself. But I believe that as a woman, we have a responsibility to speak up in the face of what we see as injustice. I also feel like we know from so much research that has been done that when the voice of women is included in the discourse of any kinds of organizations, the decision-making improves and the performance improves. And we as women need to stand up and take that responsibility.
President Drinan, thank you for both of those comments. You talk about accountability there. We reached out to the Archdiocese today. They didn't comment for today's story. I do want to point out that in October, the Cardinal announced he was hiring an external law firm to review allegations of sexual misconduct in all three seminaries in the Archdiocese of Boston as a result of another story that broke in August. Doesn't that feel like a move to accountability? Does that not feel like a genuine and tangible step in the right direction?
It does, Tiziana. So without sounding like I criticize everything that happens, let me just say that I think when you have lost as much trust as the church has lost, particularly here in Boston in the eyes of Catholics who are here, you have to overdo trying to regain the trust that you have lost. So, for example, in this particular case, it started out with investigating one of the seminaries, and then it went moved to a place where one person was appointed to oversee the investigation, who I think reasonably you could question because that person is a formal part of the archdiocese. And then finally, we went to the stage where we were going to have an outside law firm do the investigation of all three.
In order, in part, to avoid that sense of separation, I mean, of potential conflict.
That's correct. So here's the lesson from that. Do the external investigation first. Don't take the step of maybe we'll do one seminary, maybe we'll appoint somebody in the church. Go all the way to Bright. When you have this much trust at stake or loss of trust at stake, you cannot be perceived as taking half measures towards transparency.
So I wonder then, I find myself thinking as I'm listening to you, took a big step in your op-ed and suggested that there should be an investigation of the extent to which Cardinal O'Malley was aware of the activities of Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. And the cardinal had acknowledged that he made mistakes or apologized for not seeing a letter in October 15, 2015 that raised that up. Am I hearing you saying that part of the reason that you're suggesting that investigation is as a part of a desire to restore trust for the archdiocese?
Absolutely. I think that Cardinal McCarrick's fall from grace has disappointed so many Catholics across the United States who thought of him as a true role model and a substantial voice for the Catholic Church in the United States, someone that people felt proud to think that person is a cardinal in the Catholic Church. And then to find out what we have, that there were settlements made because of his behavior long ago, long before he was the prominent representative that he became for cardinals in the United States, and that was clearly known to people within the church, and to have the Pope and Cardinal O'Malley not cleared of any concern whatsoever that they didn't act on the information about the cardinal is just allowing that mistrust to continue. I don't expect any particular outcome. I would like for all Catholics to be able to say, I knew it. There was nothing to do with the cardinal in this. But to not do that leaves many people saying, this was so shocking. Cardinal McCarrick's behavior was so shocking that now he's the first person, a cardinal, who has not been able to remain a cardinal until his death. And he's in a circumstance where he's being asked to be in prayer and isolation until this church procedure is, that's a huge cloud over Cardinal McCarrick. I know he's not a cardinal anymore.
Right.
That I think you don't want to have any doubt out there.
And if at the end of such an investigation, the Catholic community could say, to use your words, I knew it, Cardinal O'Malley, you know, there was nothing there.
Right.
Does that restore trust in the archdiocese to let us move forward?
I think it goes a long way. I think there are so many people in the church who are looking for a sign that they can have faith again. And I have to say, I'm one voice, and I realize I can be a voice of not a voice that people would prefer not be out there. But what I'm saying is felt by so many Catholics. It would be such a mistake for the church in Boston to think that I'm somehow a big outlier.
Okay.
Really,
okay.
That would be a big mistake.
Now, President Dryden, there's so much more that I wanted to get mm-hmm. to, but we've only got about a minute left. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to jump to the question I'd really like to ask you. You talk about having one of your own grandchildren confirmed in the church recently, mm-hmm. and you're a steward of young people.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to say to young Catholics today?
Hold on to your faith. Your faith is the faith of generations before you. keeping it alive so that you can pass it to the next generation when hopefully the institutional church has recovered is so important. Do not lose your faith. Do not give it away because the church is in such strained times these days.
Well, with that message of faith and inspiration, that is Simmons University President Helen Drinan. President Drinan, thanks so much for being here today on Radio Boston.
You're welcome, Tiziana.
Appreciate it. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, which is Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help from Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.